We've just heard a 1957 session with Art Blakey. Featured at the piano was my guest, Sam Dockery, who is from the New Jersey area and has spent a lot of time through the years playing in Philadelphia. And as he said, musically grew up in Philadelphia, though he grew up in New Jersey. Well, we're going to be in a few minutes listening to a few other sessions that he is featured on. But first, we're going to talk for a few minutes. Sam Dockery, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here this afternoon.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like to kind of like start backwards in time and work our ways up to the present, as I frequently do. You started playing at the age of 19, which is considered by many people to be, you know, a very
quite
mature
old
age to
right.
start playing an instrument.
Right.
But you did it. You decided to do it.
Well, I was banging on the piano before the age of 19, naturally. But I didn't know exactly which way I wanted to go. I knew I wanted to play in a band, but exactly what type of music I wanted to play, I didn't have any idea until I heard Bud Powell. And that changed my whole life. Everything, you know, was like a rebirth. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I knew exactly the type of music I wanted to play. I knew exactly, I understood the harmony instantly when I heard him that day.
Where'd you hear him?
I heard him on a car radio, and a friend of mine. I was, I forget where I was going, but anyway, they had this station on. They had this jazz station on, and Bud played a selection on the piano. And I immediately felt what he was doing. I understood the harmony, and I didn't know anything about the piano.
So what happened next?
So, well, I just started playing. You know, I think from that moment on, I started to live and breathe music. I played music from Monday to Sunday. Every opportunity I got to play, I would play. And I would listen to records when the opportunity presented itself, since we couldn't afford a record player and records. But once I heard Bud, I knew exactly what I wanted to do at the time.
Had you had a piano in
no
your house?
No piano in the house. I used to go to my grandmother's house and play all the time. I'd drive her nuts. They'd hate to see me come. I'd go and bang. I'd bang on the piano. So I started playing around Camden with a saxophone. I haven't seen him in quite some time. A fellow named Reds Verdell. He played tenor. So we formed a little band. And I played in Camden, in Jersey rather, maybe about a year. And I knew, and I was quite ambitious as a young man. I wanted to play, and I wanted to play well. And I had enough common sense to know if you want to play well, you have to go where it is. So I know I had to leave Camden. So I didn't stay around Camden too long in Jersey. I came to Philadelphia, and I made it my business to seek out the best musicians and associate with them. And I learned very fast. I soaked up music like a sponge. I'd go where I'd hear the best music, and I'd sit and listen for hours, then I'd get the fellows to teach me what they could, or if they so decided to teach me anything, you know, and I would listen, and I learned pretty fast.
Where were the clubs to be then, to be hearing the best people play?
Well, now, they had a club in Philadelphia called the Blue Note at the time. I just could get in there. Also, it was a little club in Philadelphia called the name escapes me. Anyway, it was an after-hours club at 12th and Master, where all the musicians would come after work. John Coltrane would come by, Ray Bryant, a very fine pianist from Philadelphia, and I would sit and listen, and I would play also. And also, I used to work with a saxophone player around Philadelphia who's known all over the world, Jimmy Oliver, one of the fine tenor players, and I'd beg him for work, and he would give me a job. And I learned so much from those fellows.
Did you have any sense of Coltrane as the person who is going to become one of the most revered figures in jazz?
Yes, I did. Well, John Coltrane always played well. He always did from the very first time I heard him. Of course, it was a little difficult to make a living playing jazz, so John, like most musicians at the time, had to work with supper club groups, we call them, you know. And he would work with those groups, and he would constantly study, and he would go to New York and work. and he'd come back and work with those groups to keep himself going. But he was always searching, always studying. I remember I was working in a little band in Wildwood, New Jersey, and John Coltrane was working with another band at the time. And we were all staying at the same rooming house. And I'd come in from work and get up and go to the beach. And John Coltrane would be sitting at the piano studying and writing constantly, always. I guess the reason I didn't practice because I didn't know what to. I played everything naturally. You know, John, he had studied, and he would always write. Me, I'd wait till I get on the bandstand. Then I would tell my story.
The first big name group that you played with was the Buddy Rich Band when you were about 24, I guess.
Yes, that's the first big name band that I traveled with. And Buddy, he's quite an interesting personality. I guess you heard that. And fantastic drummer. He didn't impress me too much as a jazz drummer, but a very fine drummer, played extremely well, and a very fascinating drummer. And, of course, his personality is just as fascinating. But I learned a lot playing with him also. I seem to migrate towards all the drummers.
That's true, really. You've played with Blakey and Roy Haynes. And
yeah. Well, as you know, jazz is comprised of various rhythms. And I've always had a very good sense of rhythm. And drummers and I have always gotten along quite well as far as that aspect of jazz is concerned.
When you played with the Buddy Rich Band, you toured?
Yes, we toured the Midwest. We played Michigan. We played, where else did we go? We played Minneapolis. And I can't recall the other town. But anyway, we did a tour of the Midwest. And it was great. We had two fellows from Philadelphia, two local musicians, and myself, Billy Root, who is now in Las Vegas, and a very good bass player named Jimmy Mobley. Played very well, just the trio, and we really had a ball, and Buddy enjoyed it immensely. Every night we had a ball.
Did you travel on a bus when you were touring?
Well, we traveled by car, and Buddy was very rich, as he is now. And he had a valet to take our bags. We didn't have to do anything but just play. Oh, it was great. First class. Yeah.
What do you think of him as a leader, you know, musically?
Buddy, as a leader, what can I say? Buddy was a little dictatorial at the time, but I had my gang with me, so he was outnumbered, so to speak. Buddy's a good leader. You know, as leaders go, leaders are leaders. You know, what can you say about leaders?
Okay. Well, I want to, in a few minutes, listen to a session that's been released by Columbia, on which you're featured in a jam session with Clifford Brown. But yes. I'd like to talk a little bit about that encounter first. It was actually the last concert that he played, and it was in Philadelphia. How did that all get organized, that
well, it's a
jam session?
Fellow in Philadelphia by the name of Ellis Tolan, he owns Music City. And I met Ellis in the 50s. He had his store is presently located, I don't mean to give a commercial, but it's located in the 1800 block of Chestnut Street. It was located at that time at 11th and Chestnut. And he gave concerts. He still had the music store same as he has today. But anyway, he gave concerts at 7:30 in the evening so the younger people could hear jazz. And I thought it was a very good idea. And he hired me in the rhythm section. We didn't know each other at the time, but someone had mentioned my name to him. So when we started playing together, it was love at first sight. You know, we played together very well. And I worked for him, I imagine, for a year or two. I can't recall how long. But I met all the musicians that way. I met, Clifford Brown, the one I did the album with. I met the members of Art Blakey's band. I never met Art there. I met the Sidemen in his band at the time. The trumpet player, I can't think of his name, Blackbirds. Who's the fellow that has?
Oh, Donald Byrd.
Donald Byrd. I met Donald Byrd at the time. And the bass player who was with him, he got killed also. So many musicians got killed. That's one of the sad aspects of jazz, one of the sad memories I have of it. But anyway, getting back to Music City, I met a lot of musicians there. And I think working there with Ellis was very instrumental in getting me out on the jazz scene, in meeting the various musicians, because he brought almost everyone he could who came to town to work at the Blue Note. They worked for him. And they would appear there rather to play for the children, and I was in the rhythm section, and they liked the way I played. So the rest is record history.
It's kind of lovely, isn't it? Usually, if someone goes to a jam session, in addition to a date that they're booked for, it's after hours. And here they were coming at 7:30 so that the young people could hear. 7:30,
so I thought that was wonderful. It's great.
Was this night the night that this session was recorded, the first time you'd met Clifford Brown?
I'm trying to recall. I know Clifford and I, we had played together quite a few times at private jam sessions. He would get together and some local fellas. I don't know exactly whether that was the first time I met him or not. It probably was, as far as I can recall. But we have played together a lot, not in clubs, but at jam sessions at various friends' homes. And anyway, everyone was quite impressed. This particular date was done so long ago, I don't really recall too much about it, as I mentioned to you earlier.
Well, yeah. I'd like to play now one of the selections from that 1956 date that's been issued now on an album called Clifford Brown, the First and Last Recorded Performances of One of the Greatest Soloists in the History of Jazz, a rather lengthy title.
Yes.
Yeah, now this has been issued by Columbia Records. Actually, there's an interesting story which I wish you'd tell about how it got released, because it wasn't recorded in a studio or recorded by a record company that night.
No, it wasn't recorded. That was, it's a fellow named Fred Miles. Everyone knows him in Philadelphia, all the musicians. He made a tape, as he did of quite a few of those sessions we had with Kay Wending, J.J. Johnson, and Ben Webster. Anyway, he made a tape of this particular session. And after Clifford got killed, after Clifford was killed in the accident, Fred approached me that he was trying to sell the tape to a record company, and he was unsuccessful. I think he tried for quite some time to sell that tape. Anyway, he was successful later on, I imagine, because the jazz is becoming installed in the institutions now. The college kids seem to like jazz, and they should. It's a very it's valid music. And he sold the tape to a record company, and I got paid for it after they made the tape. But a cousin of mine told me he'd heard the album in New York before. I think he told me before I saw Fred, before Fred told me he had sold it to the company. Anyway, I'm quite pleased that it was. I don't remember too much about it, but I'm very happy to be part of that young man's career. One of the truly geniuses of jazz, and he's going down in history as one of the true geniuses of jazz, Clifford Brown.
That's for sure. Well, from this from this session that was recorded the last night of Clifford Brown's life, we're going to hear a recording of Donna Lee, and again Clifford Brown featured on trumpet, and my guest Sam Dockery featured at the piano. Thank you.
so wonderful. Really. It's been a pleasure being here. I really must go now. It's so hot.
Yeah, what do you say? Let's hear it for Clifford Brown, huh?
We've just heard a recording of Donna Lee as recorded in Philadelphia in 1956. My guest Sam Dockery was featured on the piano on that recording. The session is featured on an album on Columbia called Clifford Brown, the First and Last Recorded Performances of One of the Greatest Soloists in the History of Jazz. And as we were mentioning before, Sam, that was the last night of Clifford
right.
Brown's life. He was
absolutely.
Very tragically killed in a car crash along with
right.
Richie Powell after that performance. What did that do to you, having just played with him, finding out about that?
Well, I was stunned, naturally. You know, what can you, how do you feel when something like that happens? You feel a little numb. You don't know what to say or do. There's nothing to say or do. I know Max Roach, the band leader at the time he was working with, took it very hard. Max really took it hard for quite some time. And all of us did, really, because he was such a fine person. Besides being a great trumpet player, he was a gentleman, a fine person, extremely intelligent, very soft-spoken, very unaffected by his ability to play. I think when you play that well, you are unaffected. It's something you do naturally, and it's something you enjoy doing. And I think it's a way that you really communicate with people. And you do. I think a jazz musician is very fortunate when he can play like that, because he has an extra way of telling people how he feels, you know. And Clifford was one of those type person. I had an opportunity to know him personally. A very fine person, and he played so well.
You know, it's really sad, but it seems that, you know, some of the great, like too many of the great jazz musicians have just really died tragically at
yes,
the,
I've
young
heard,
ages.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people say, I've talked to Betty Carter, one of the great jazz singers. She's another wonderful artist that I've played with. And she's mentioned the fact that, I don't know if I want to accept this, that when your work is done, you seem to leave here. You know, I think the creator, the deems it fit that when your work is done, you go. She accepted his death like that. But it's a little difficult for me to do that. You know, a person so young, I think he had much more to say than he did, personally. I feel that way, you know, so it was a little difficult for me to accept his death like that, so young.
Did facing that kind of, you know, knowledge of mortality make you, like, change your lifestyle at all? Like, make you want to, like, live cleaner or just say, well, who cares, because life really is short, and just, like, live more rough after that?
Well, I spoke to Jimmy Heath about that. I made a comment. Jimmy and I used to work around Philadelphia a lot before he moved to New York City. And I said something to Jimmy to the effect that, Jimmy, you know, this business is a killer. I said, you know, it really cuts your days short. And Jimmy made a comment. He didn't comment too much about that. He thought about it. And we didn't say too much more after that, after I made that statement. I think most jazz musicians think about that. I've seen so many of them go so young, so talented, and I don't know whether we stop to think about it or we just keep on going and just hope that nothing happens, you know, before we tell the story that we really want to tell, you know. So I don't actually know whether musicians really think about that. They just keep going.
Yeah.
That's all.
Do you want to say a few words about any of the other musicians who were featured on that session that we just heard?
Yes, it's a tenor player there named Ziggy Vines. Mel Levin, a very fine tenor player. He was a little before me. I remember when I first started playing, a few musicians in Camden that I know mentioned his name, and they commented about how well he played. And when I heard him, he truly did play very well. And I don't know why he never went on to do bigger and better things than he did. I mean, than he, than he accomplished. But I imagine that's another story. Anyway, Billy Root, a very fine tenor player, who I thought was going very far in the jazz field, I guess he decided to make a living. He has a family, and he moved to Las Vegas, where he works steady. And after all, when you play music, you still have to go to the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And they accept money. You must bring money. So Billy has a family. He works steady. So who am I to say? What can I say?
Okay. If you're just tuning in now, I'm in the studio with Sam Dockery, who's a pianist who now lives in the Camden area. And we're talking about his music and some of the recordings that he's featured on. We're going to be hearing a few more sessions in a few minutes. The one that we just heard was recorded back in 56, and about 57, I think it was, you joined as one of Art Blakey's jazz messengers.
Yes, the latter part of 56.
The latter part of 56.
Right.
How did you meet up with him? You said that in that club in Philly you met some of the people who were playing with him. But
yes,
I
met some of the sidemen, and they seemed to be quite impressed with my playing, and they related that to Art Blakey. So I don't know exactly how it happened. I don't know whether Art called me to work with him or somebody brought me along. Anyway, we met through someone else. And, of course, the year that I joined the band, I think the first job was a jazz concert in Randall's Island. And you can't imagine my nervousness going out for the first job playing in a big open field with a baby grand and I can't see anyone. But it was good. It was good that night. And then after that, we recorded. I think we recorded immediately or not too long after I joined the band. Anyway, it was a good band. We became a family. We enjoyed each other. And we got along like a bunch of kids, And we played, and Art Blakey, a true artist, played so well. And
is he kind of fatherly to the people in the band?
Yes, he is. He is the fatherly type. He always gave us advice. And
about your personal life and your playing?
Right, personal life and playing. He would point out the pitfalls for us to avoid. Although I must admit that I come from a very conservative family background. I avoid pitfalls naturally. So anyway, he was a great teacher. I learned quite a bit from him as a man, Art Blakey, as well as musically. And also, it was my first venture with a big-name band for any length of time. I think I stayed with Art about a year and a half to 2 years. And he was quite instrumental in getting my name out before the public. I recorded on the biggest labels and quite extensively with Art Blakey. And I enjoyed every bit of it.
How did his drum playing affect your piano playing, do you think?
Well, I think Art and I thought alike in that he was an extremely dynamic drummer, and I was a dynamic pianist. I only played what I felt. I didn't know anything. And I felt quite a bit. And Art Blakey feels quite a bit when he sits down to play. So I think it was a perfect marriage. Perfect. Yes?
No, go ahead.
No. And we got along together musically just great. I remember the first time we went to California, we worked opposite Chet Baker. And Chet Baker had some very good, fine musicians in his band. I think he had Bobby Timmons from Philadelphia at the time. He had a bass player from Philadelphia named Jimmy Bond, who started to be a classical bassist but wound up being a jazz bassist. He went to Juilliard, I believe. Anyway, to make a long story short, with the fine musicians that Chet Baker had in his band, we were so dynamic, he didn't last too long, I'm afraid. And we stayed. They extended the time that we were supposed to stay in Hollywood. And we also came back for a repeat engagement.
Well, when you were with Blakey, that was the first time you went into a recording studio to,
yes, that's true,
do albums. How did you like that? Being in a studio instead of a club?
Recordings for a jazz musician is quite a cold business. Usually before a jazz musician feels like really hits his stride, he's got to be playing for at least 2 or 3 hours. I know myself, if I start playing at 9 o'clock, I don't really feel like playing until 1. Then I'm just warm. And when you go into a studio, you have to wait for the engineer to turn the light on and point his finger at you, and you have to start like you're getting ready to run a race. And it doesn't work like that. When you're being creative, you can't turn that on and off. That's something that has to build. You know, some days you feel like playing and some days you don't.
Were there any producers that you've worked with on any sessions who went out of their way to try to make the environment as warm or as comfortable for playing as possible?
I'm glad you brought that up. Now that you mention it, I'm trying to recall some, and I can't recall any right now. I did a session, one particular session that I think they tried to make us feel comfortable, was the Vic album. That was a subsidiary of RCA Victor, their jazz label. And we did a session that night that lasted from 12 o'clock at night till 5 in the morning. And I think that's when Johnny Griffin first joined the band. I think Art Blakey flew Johnny Griffin from Chicago into New York to do that record session. And a very fine tenor player he is. You're going to hear quite a bit from Johnny Griffin. Anyway, I think the reason that was so relaxed is because we were allowed the time. We had the latitude of time. We went in the studio at 12 o'clock and we left 5 in the morning. Everybody was tired and also very loose. I wasn't too happy at the time with my playing. Now that I reflect on it again, I don't think I sounded too bad, but at the time I wasn't too happy with it. But anyway, that is the most relaxed date I can think of right now.
Is that...
I think that's on RC Victor. I don't think you had that.
No, okay, that's...
Yeah, I have that at home. I intended to bring that with me, but an oversight.
Well, we're going to hear a session with Blakey now. That it's a piece by Johnny Griffin, who you just mentioned. It's called Shorty, and this was recorded in 1957, and it's Art Blakey drums and Sabu on congas.
Right.
Bill Hardeman trumpet, Johnny Griffin on tenor, Spanky DeBrest bass. My guest, Sam Dockery, at the piano. Do you remember the session? You want to say a few words about it before we hear it?
I remember that very vaguely. Trying to recall, what do I remember about that date? I remember it was a very difficult date for me. I always had trouble practicing in New York, and we recorded a lot during that time. And I had I commuted between New York and my home. And I could never find a piano, and those dates were always so difficult for me. I remember that about it. I think that I don't know whether Art Blakey brought a tune in on that date. Anyway, Johnny Griffin wrote some tunes. Wrote a tune, one tune he wrote?
Yeah. That,
Shorty.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, everybody in the group enjoyed Johnny Griffin's playing. I remember Johnny Griffin as a kid working with Lionel Hampton. When I was a little boy, I used to go to a theater in Camden called the Stanley Theater, and he was working with Lionel at the time. He was called the Boy Wonder Saxophonist. I think Johnny Griffin must have been about 16 at the time. And, of course, Lionel Hampton had a house-rocking band, we call it, at the time. Johnny Griffin played the house-rocking type of saxophone. And I had always pictured him as a house-rocking saxophone player. So when he joined Art Blakey's band and played so fluently and so well, I was amazed because I was familiar with him as a youngster. But he's truly a fine saxophone player.
Great.
Truly.
Well, let's hear the session. It's a piece by Johnny Griffin. It's called Shorty. Johnny Griffin on tenor. My guest, Sam Dockery, at the piano.
Thank you.
That was Shorty, a piece by Johnny Griffin with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers as recorded in 1957 with my guest Sam Dockery at the piano. If you're just joining us now, Sam Dockery is a jazz and classical pianist who is from the area, now lives in Camden, spent a lot of musical time in the Philadelphia area. He's played with Buddy Rich and Art Blakey. Roy Haynes, as we'll be hearing in just a few minutes, and a number of other people. We were talking a little bit about being in the recording studio before we heard that session. Then there's the aftermath of that. Like, what happens when an album like the one we just heard is reissued years after you were in the recording studio? That was the session we heard was originally on an album called Q-Pop, which was on Jubilee Records, and it's recently been reissued on Roulette Records. Did you know about that, Sam? Did that tell you?
The only thing I know about the reissues are what people tell me. Every time I meet people, they tell me, well, Sam, I have an album of yours home on so-and-so label. Now, I know almost all the labels that I recorded on. Now, some of the labels that they quote me that they have, I'm not familiar with. Although, I have seen some reissues of some of the albums I've done with Art Blakey on another Columbia album. I remember one recording we did called Cranky Spanky. I believe that's on the Hard Bop album. That's an old high fidelity, hi-fi recording. And they reissued that on a Columbia album along with Miles Davis and a lot of other people in their bands. So I don't know what to say. I don't really have time to listen to my own records, but people tell me they hear them. And I'm happy to hear about the reissue. As far as the albums I've done, that means jazz is becoming popular again. And all the fellows that have given their lives to this business, it seems to be paying off. Although I don't see that much monetarily from it, I'm just happy that it's getting out there. That's something to be said for that.
We've been listening to some of your jazz playing this afternoon because we don't have a piano in the studio, and there's no way for us to this afternoon be listening to some of your classical playing. But you began studying classical music in 1962. You're now playing it and teaching it. What attracted you to go that route and to learn the classical approach to music, to learn classical music?
Well, that happened quite by, how can I put it? That happened, I can't say quite by accident, because I went to a classical teacher. So when you go to a classical teacher, he teaches you classical music, naturally. But my purpose for going to my teacher was to study, to learn how to read. I couldn't read when I first joined Art Blakey. That was part of my musical background that was lacking. So I decided to do something about it. When I start studying with my teacher, he introduced me to classical music. When I started, I didn't start at the early stages, the beginning stage, because I'd been playing for so long and with so many good musicians, and some of it rubbed off, I think. Anyway, my teacher saw to it that he thought that I didn't need to start at the very beginning. Anyway, as I advanced in my studies, I began to compare the harmonic structure, which jazz is based on, with the classical structure. And I found so many similarities between the harmonic structure of, say, a piece by Chopin and some of the harmonies that I had been playing for years in jazz. And I would relate them to my teacher. And the more I would play classical music and relate it to what I already knew, the more fascinated I became. And that fascination still holds till today. I find Chopin a very harmonic composer, beautiful composer. And a lot of the harmonies, as I said before, that I played with the Chopin compositions, I played for years with jazz, a lot of years. A lot of the chord structures. And that fascinated me.
Do you ever perform anything from the classical repertoire at any of your club dates?
Well, I used to play a few Bach inventions that I committed to memory just to show off. But I never liked to mix the two. Some friends of mine had suggested that on some of my club dates I should play a classical composition in a jam, but I never. The two are parallel. They have some things in common, but still the concept, there's two completely different concepts of music. See, jazz is instant composition. Classical music, when you're playing, is a prepared composition by someone else. When you're performing jazz-wise, that's your instant composition, plain and simple. So I hope to perform classically someday. If I'm so fortunate to, my studies are going quite well.
Some people see one form as being more valid than the other.
Absolutely not. No, indeed. Anyone who thinks classical music is more valid than jazz or just aren't informed. For the simple reason that traditional music is based on harmony. Now, when you play jazz, in order to improvise, unless you're going to play the new avant-garde jazz. If traditional jazz, Charlie Parker, if you know anything about harmony, you can hear the chord progressions through all of his solos. A beautiful, another Mozart, Charlie Parker was. And in order for someone to compose a classical piece, they have to know harmony. It's as simple as that. Now, that's where the similarity comes in as far as classical music and jazz. And the people who teach classical music can't see the validity in that, just aren't informed. Leonard Bernstein, he sees the connection. And I'm quite sure you know about his background.
Yeah.
Everyone does. Sure.
Well, we are just about out of time, I'm sorry to
say. I'm sorry, too. I really enjoyed
this. I've really been enjoying it, too. Sam Dockery, I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed listening to your records, and I've enjoyed speaking with you. We're going to hear another one of your records, which I hope you have a couple of minutes to tell us a little bit about before we hear it. This is one of the sessions with Roy Haynes, a piece called Invitation. Do you want to say a few words about the session?
Yes. That's a session we did in California when I went out there with Roy Haynes to work at Shelley's Manhole. We did that recording. And I'm on there with some very fine musicians. Roy Haynes is one of the world's great drummers. I saw Roy as a very young man in Philadelphia. He's been around quite a bit. But the opportunity to play with him, I can't tell you how valuable that was. And Frank Strozier, the saxophonist on the record session, is also a very fine musician. And Larry Ridley, who teaches at the Livingston Music School of the section of Rutgers that teaches jazz in North Jersey.
Okay, well, before we hear it, I want to thank you, Sam Dockery, once
thank
again.
You.
Sam Dockery thank you. Is a jazz and classical pianist, now lives in Camden, New Jersey. You might want to keep your eyes open to find out when and where he plays in clubs, etc., around the Delaware Valley area. He also teaches both jazz and classical piano. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. We're going to hear now from an album on the Pacific Jazz label under the leadership of Roy Haynes. We'll hear Invitation with Roy Haynes on drums, Frank Strozier on reed, Sam Dockery piano, Larry Ridley bass.